Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great night, great day, wherever you are. We are back for yet another great episode of the show. It is episode 52, and we got a great one today. I have had so many people contact me and say, hey, when are you doing Momo? When are you doing Giancana? Well, today's the day. We're going to talk about Sam Giancana, one of really the most, politically powerful mobsters really ever. One of the more fascinating mobsters ever. This is a guy in Sam Giancana who really saw it all. I mean, he was the boss of one of the most powerful criminal syndicates in the country. He had his hands in many layers of American society. He was involved very much with the election of John Fitzgerald Kennedy in the early 60s, late 50s. He was integral in really a plot to kill a dictator. And really by the end, as we are well aware in Chicago, there were certain guys that just bit off more than they could chew. They became distractions. They became issues. And in the end, Sam Giancana just did too much. He has a wildly interesting life. And I think, when we look back at really everyone we've covered, I think some of the more fascinating people are, Greg Scarpa is really interesting. Sonny Franzese, Tony Accardo. But I mean, Sam Giancana is just fascinating. He really is. And he's a guy that has so many layers. He comes from really a tough place. And, for a lot of Sam Giancana's early life, particularly in his criminal life, he really wasn't respected. People looked at him as kind of out there, kind of weird, nutty kind of guy. No one really looked at him as a leader. And it would actually be a woman that would change his life. And we'll get to all that and more here on the show. I look forward to chatting with you. As always, if you enjoy our show, I urge you, please leave us a deserved review. And if you want, make sure you leave us a comment in the comment section. Also, make sure you check us out on Twitter. And I urge you, go follow us on Twitter if you have it. It's where I do show updates. I throw polls out. I interact with the people. And a lot of the time I throw out, interesting mob facts, on a given day and stuff you might enjoy. So make sure you check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Also, one of the big things I urge you to do is go check us out on YouTube as well. I put up a lot of content on YouTube, really just extra content, maybe not long enough for a show, or just things that I find interesting. Occasionally I interview people. So you can check us out on YouTube just by searching the Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. So without further ado, this is a pretty long one. This is a pretty winded one. So let's jump into it. Sam Giancana on the Sit Down. Guillermo Giancana was born in June of 1908. He was born in Chicago, and Sam Giancana's parents were actually hailing from Sicily, as we know. Many Italian mobsters' parents were either from southern Italy or from Sicily. And his parents actually emigrated to Chicago, and he would grow up in an area of the city called the Patch. It was really the Little Italy of Chicago at the time. They called it the Spaghetti Section. It was really just where mostly Italian immigrants lived. And at that time, it was a really tough area. There were immigrants just trying to get by. They were flocking there in droves, big families, not a ton of work. Initially, Sam's father actually sold fruit as a street vendor on one of the main thoroughfares of the Patch. Sadly, though, Sam Giancana's mother would actually die at 2 years old. She died from complications from some pregnancies that she had. And he really never had that motherly love, Sam Giancana. It was noted that his father was actually pretty abusive. He would regularly beat Sam over the littlest things. And this is, I think, really where Sam was guided into the streets. He didn't have anybody at home. He really had no direction. And at one point, it was actually noted that Sam Giancana's father would actually chain him to trees and beat him. He'd leave him there all hours of the night. And the goal was really to beat the bad out of him. But it didn't work. It really just drove Sam more into the streets. By the age of 10, he was expelled from school. He would spend some time in reform school, but it wouldn't last. By 13, Sam would join a notorious street gang known as the 42 Gang. And we talked about the 42 Gang a little bit when we went over people like Sam DeStefano. Sam and Mario DeStefano actually came up in the 42 Gang. Milwaukee Phil Adoricio grew up in the 42 Gang. Sam Battaglia, Louis Frado, lot of Chicago legend as far as in the criminal world grew up in the 42 Gang. And they really were one of the more prominent gangs. They were basically a farm team full of hitters for the outfit. And during Prohibition, they really got their start. They were running what they would call bootlegging gangs. And they were running stuff for Capone and for other people. And, you know, the thing about Sam Giancana, he really stuck out quickly in the 42 Gang because while he was a little out there, he was known to be pretty smart. He was an accomplished wheelman. He was a great driver. He was always able to get people out of things. And as we know, in the early 20s, Prohibition really was all-encompassed in Chicago. Everybody was on the take. The city was corrupt, and gangsters were making millions off of illegal alcohol. The 42 Gang was integral in kind of continuing the supply. They were also integral in controlling gambling, murder for hire, all sorts of different things. And Sam Giancana was really one of the more prominent members because it was clear that unlike most of the street thugs, he really had a bit of a smarts to him. And he was very much taken on by kind of some upper echelon people. At one point, over kind of a 9-year run between the mid-20s to the early 30s, the 42 Gang was suspected in killing 4 different police officers during that time. They killed countless other people. They were very notorious. And by 18 in 1925, Sam Giancana would actually be arrested for stealing cars. This is when he begins kind of being involved in some murder investigations. At one point, Sam Giancana was an alleged doer in 4 different homicides. Now, ultimately, he was never convicted, but he was the prime subject in 3 of them. But you know what? As we know, I mean, this is the late 20s, early 30s. It is very easy to kill people back then. There's no cameras. There's no DNA. There's no cell phone records. You know, quite honestly, you have to wonder, how did they ever solve a murder back then? I mean, unless you had a witness or, you know, you had a cop seeing you do it. I mean, it's really impossible. You know, it's interesting. You never quite really think about murder. You know, nowadays it's really tough to kill somebody. But when we really think about it, even nowadays, if you have any sorts of like smarts whatsoever, and you don't involve a cell phone and you wear a mask, it's very difficult to catch somebody, especially if you're on foot. You know, you can get away with a lot of things. I was watching an episode the other day of Verse 48, and there was a guy, you know, he killed somebody on camera. You can see him. He had a mask on, though. And they had the suspect in the room, and they basically said, like, there's nothing we can do. Unless we could tie a cell phone record to this guy, we can't just assume it was him behind the mask. It looks like him. Looks like his body type, but that's not enough to hold up in a court of law. Now, for this guy, it ended up not working out for him because the cell phone pegged him to where he was. But you know, you think about it, if he didn't use a cell phone, he probably would have got away. And you look back to this time, it was probably incredibly hard to solve murders at that point. You know, you would have to have some real connections in the community or whatever. And as we know in Chicago, I'm guessing the clearance rate for murder back then was not very high. Sam Giancana would actually be arrested for something, though, and he actually be convicted. In 1929, he would be convicted of burglary and larceny and get 1 to 5 years in the Joliet Correctional Facility where he would spend his first prison time. And that was really, you know, one of the only times he would go to prison. The other time we'll talk about would actually end up being a really big thing for him. But if Sam Giancana didn't spend a lot of time in prison, this is also around the time when Sam would actually meet Al Capone. And it's alleged that in the murder of Johnny Torrio, or not the alleged murder of Johnny Torrio, it was actually alleged that one of the gunmen that day was Sam Giancana. Actually, he had connections to Al Capone, and you know, this would ultimately be what would allow Al Capone to take over the outfit in 1925. Al pretty much said to Johnny Torrio, "You need to get out of the way," pretty much. And it was alleged that Johnny Torrio was involved with that. As I said, he would go away in 1929, and Sam Giancana would actually get out of prison in 1932. But, you know, in prison, when you're a guy like Sam Giancana, you really just use it as a way to become a better criminal. You start meeting different people. You start learning about other rackets. And by this point, Sam Giancana is just an associate. He's a driver. He's a murder-for-hire guy. He's involved in some different rackets, but he's really not doing a whole hell of a lot. And keep in mind, by this point in 1932, the outfit's kind of moving in a different direction. Al Capone, as we know, really didn't have a long time in power. He was really only in power to like the real early 1930s. And once the St. Valentine's Day massacre happens and everything, Al Capone would end up getting arrested in 1929. And that was really the latest we'd see him in power. Frank Nitti would take over the outfit and would really take it in a different direction. As I've said time and time again, under Al Capone, the outfit was a gang. Obviously, they had a little bit of a seat on the commission, but Al Capone really treated it as a gang. People like Nitti, Paul Rica, Tony Accardo really moved it into being a full-fledged criminal organization and a family. As I said, Sam Giancana was vicious. He was decisive. He was a leader. And he was really smart. And as I said, you know, that's really the great equalizer for being a high-level mobster. The guys that we remember, the guys that are legends in the mafia are the ones that can earn, they can make decisive decisions, they can be leaders, and they can also chop your fucking head off. And Sam Giancana could do all of them. In 1932, though, it would all change for Sam Giancana, and it would change in a pretty good way. That time, he would meet a beautiful woman called Angeline Dettulvi. Dettulvi was educated. She was a good woman. She came from a good family. Her parents were actually from the Italian region of Basilicata. And she fell in love with Sam. And they were smitten with each other. And, you know, like any good woman for a man, even in the criminal game, you know, sometimes you can meet a woman and you want to change for her. You know, you want to become a different person because you want to build a life with her. And that's exactly what Sam Giancana did. Upon his release from prison, he really decided that his years of being a killer and a tough guy were for likely over. And he had to figure out new ways to make money for him and for his wife. He wanted to be with Angeline Dettulvi. And life was good for him. He was happy. He was gleaming. He knew he wanted to have a family someday. And he decided to basically trade in his criminal career for more or less a racketeer career, which would end up paying huge dividends for Sam Giancana. It was alleged by his future daughters that at one point they would say that Sam Giancana adored his wife. He would end up having three daughters, Francine, Bonnie, and Antoinette. And they would talk kind of openly about how great of a father Sam was. They would talk about that. Always, they would sit down for dinner. He would ask them about their day. They would go on vacations. He was a great father by all accounts. It was also kind of common knowledge that Sam Giancana was a charismatic guy. He was likable. He had that kind of zeal to him, that panache. And he was also a Robin Hood type. He was also very giving. He was always someone that would be willing to help somebody if they needed it. And around this time, he would start driving for Paul Rica. He was doing things. He was making himself more insulated. He wasn't getting involved with street crimes. He was learning how to make bigger money. And he would start really moving into, once Prohibition was lifted, it still didn't mean that Prohibition had ended, but people were still looking to buy alcohol on the black market. They could get it for better prices. And Sam Giancana knew that. He would actually ultimately do that and make money, but he would also get pinched in the late 30s, and he would go to prison. He would head to sue a federal bid. He was first at Leavenworth, and then he would head to Terre Haute. And Interestingly enough, this is really where Sam Giancana's life changed for the better. As I said, he realized that with a family, he needed to start making money. He needed to be a different father and not go to prison and to the federal penitentiary for his whole life. But as I said, prison was a breeding ground for people like Sam Giancana. And this is where he would meet someone that would ultimately change his life. And he would really change the lives of both the people involved. Sam would meet an individual called Ed Jones. Ed Jones was very well known in the Black underworld in Chicago. For anyone that's not aware, in the 30s, 40s, and really into the 70s, the numbers rackets were gigantic. We talked about the numbers racket at length during the Tony Salerno episode. Many gangsters really in those days came up with numbers banks. But the numbers rackets were incredibly big in the Black population of Chicago, New York, Detroit, some of the different areas. As we know, at one point in really from the late 1800s into the 1930s, 1940s, the Great Migration would happen. And a lot of people, Black people from Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina, all these different Georgia, all these different areas would head north and they'd head into the cities, whether it was Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Indianapolis. And one of the hubs for Black excellence, Black culture was in Chicago. Ed Jones had, along with two of his brothers, come from Mississippi. He would settle in Chicago and he would actually buy a tailor shop and put his brothers to work. But in the back end of the tailor shop, Ed Jones was running numbers out of the back. And for anyone that's not aware of what numbers are basically the lottery. You would pay a penny or a dime or a nickel, and you could pick numbers and try to make spend a little to make a lot. And as we know with the lottery, it's very addicting. It doesn't cost a lot, and people are willing to play it daily, especially in nation's ghettos. People are always looking to make a quick buck, and the policy racket, numbers racket was gigantic. At one point, Ed Jones made a ton of money. He had numbers runners that per day were making $2,000 to $10,000. Now, remember, in the late 30s, that's 35, 40 grand a day. Ed Jones was making a lot of money, and he was the head and the king in Southside for numbers. At one point in the early 40s, it was actually alleged that Ed Jones and his triumvirate were bringing in about $25 million a year, which in those days equates to about $360 million a year. This guy was making big, big money. And what he was doing is he was taking a lot of money. He was putting it back into the community. He was creating jobs for people. He was the cat's meow on the South Side. Ed Jones knew how to make money. And he would meet Sam Giancana at Terre Haute, and they became friends. He would teach Sam Giancana about the numbers racket in Chicago. Numbers were a part of things, but for the most part, the Blacks were making the money in the numbers, and they were, for the most part, separate from the outfit. And look, the outfit realized, and this is where Sam Giancana was smart. He was a manipulator, but he was smart. He realized, well, if they're making all this money, I'll get in good with these guys, maybe get them to stake me, and then in the end, I'll just take it from them. Because in the end, the outfit, it was a one-boss town in Chicago. The outfit was king. It was that simple. And Sam realized that he could take his knowledge of this newfound numbers racket and his connections in the Black community and go to Tony Accardo and say, look, you're the new boss now. You, Eureka, I can make a lot of money for this family. And this is around the time when Sam Giancana is likely elevated from being just an associate to a member of the outfit. Once he was released from prison, Ed Jones would actually stake Sam Giancana of about $100,000. And this would be to run some of the very profitable jukebox business that Ed Jones was running. Now, he was taking and kicking up nice envelopes to the family, to the outfit. And this would allow Sam to move his family out of the patch and into a nice suburb called Oak Park. He would buy a home on a corner and enjoyed his life with his daughters. He wanted more, though, and Sam Giancana always realized that he didn't want to just be a regular guy. He wanted to be in the upper echelons of the family, and he knew that the quickest way to do that was taking over the numbers game. So that's exactly what he does. He basically goes to Ed Jones, kidnaps him, and gives him really a simple request. Get lost, leave Chicago, take all your money and run. We own the numbers racket now. And Ed Jones was not a confrontational individual. He did have political power, but it was only in the black community. And he knew that the outfit wasn't going to fuck around. He was going to get killed. And Giancana really was so smart because this worked like a charm. The problem that Giancana would have and arise was Jones would leave. He would actually leave and flee to Mexico. And that is somewhere where he would live for the next 5 to 10 years. The problem that Sam Giancana would have is the other people that were involved in the numbers racket were not willing to just quickly move on. One of the emissaries that Ed Jones had was a guy called Tough Teddy Rowe. Teddy Rowe was probably the most profitable numbers bank runner for Ed Jones, and Tough Teddy was not willing to go down as quick. And he had regular run-ins with Giancana. Giancana told him at one point he was going to fucking kill him. And Teddy Rowe, in all accounts, was a tough guy. He was not going to just give control up. But as we know, the mob always wins. There was to actually go on from 1947 to 1951. And at one point, it got pretty crazy. Teddy Rowe would actually shoot an individual called Fat Lenny Caifano, who was a member of Sam's crew. He was a close friend to Sam. And that would be really the end for Teddy Rowe. At one point, not only did Sam Giancana want retribution, but Fat Lenny had a brother called Marshall Caifano, who was a big tough guy in the outfit. They would stalk Teddy Rowe in 1952 to a Southside apartment that he owned on Michigan Avenue. As he walked to his car, Caifano would appear out of nowhere and shoot him 8 times and kill him on the scene. Interestingly enough, in the 70s, Sam Giancana was actually caught on wiretap discussing Teddy Rowe and that, quote, "It's a fucking shame we had to kill him. He was a tough motherfucker." But that's really how it went with the outfit. You either got down or laid down. And this is what would propel Sam Giancana to the upper echelons of the outfit. He made millions of dollars for the outfit through the numbers racket. And this really allowed him to completely take it over by upheavaling everyone involved in a black community and taking it over. By 1955, everything was firmly in control as far as the numbers rackets, and money meant power, as we know. Everybody was happy in his family. His daughters were being well taken care of, and he lived well. The problem was in 1954, throughout his relationship with Angeline Ditolvi, she actually was always very sick. They would actually start to vacation a lot in Florida due to the cold winters. It really would get to Angeline. And sadly, in April of 1954, Angeline Ditolvi would die. And according to Sam's daughters, he was never really the same after that. And this would really, I think, really change the trajectory of Sam Giancana's life. Before her death, his daughters would talk about regularly that, you know, they did everything as a family. They always went on vacations. They loved watching movies. Sam Giancana loved to golf. You know, one of his daughters is actually a great golfer. He and his wife were very loyal to each other. And they would actually watch movies all the time together. And they were very much in love. And when she dies, when Angeline Ditolvi dies, it was really, as I said, a turning point in Sam Giancana's life. Things changed a lot. You know, he acted more flamboyant, according to his daughters. He was more ostentatious. He was kind of not as careful. It was always said that Sam Giancana, as I talked about, was very smart. He was very cunning. He was always one step ahead of the law. He always was very familiar with surveillance and wiretapping and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, he really kind of let his guard down, and he started to really change, started to become kind of a playboy during this time. And the good thing for Giancana was he actually was becoming a real powerful guy in the outfit. By 1957, Paul Rica and Tony Accardo really had decided to kind of step down and kind of get out of the way. Rica kind of retired. He was still involved, and so was Accardo. They were kind of smart in knowing that Ultimately, Sam Giancana was going to take shit. If they throw him in as front boss, they can kind of work in the background. Tony can act as a consigliere. And Sam Giancana quickly steps in as front boss in 1957. He would actually attend Apalachin. A lot of people will talk about that. And at one point, Sam Giancana is actually heard on wiretap discussing that after the meeting and after the feds bust it and the local police bust it, that we should have had it in Chicago. It's the safest place in the world. And that they had the area locked up tight. So Sam wasn't happy. He ended up getting away, but he wasn't happy because he was probably right. They should have had it in Chicago. Most of Sam's crew was very close. There were a few people involved. Jackie Cerrone was very close to Sam Giancana. Chucky English was very close to Sam Giancana. But his real close confidant was a guy called Dominic Butch Blassie. Blassie was a butcher by trade, but he was also a gangster. And it was said that he was Sam's closest ally and confidant. He did everything for Sam. He was like a brother. They were very close. And these guys really controlled a lot of rackets in Chicago. Chucky English was very big in the jukebox business on the West Side. Cerrone would elevate and become very powerful. And, you know, Butch Blassie was really the eyes and ears in the streets for Sam Giancana. The thing about Apalachin that really changed the future of the mob was it really put the mob on federal oversight at this point. And what we would start to see is in the late 50s, early 60s, certain families in every area started getting their own task force. And that was no different in Chicago. Bill Romer was the head of the feds at that point, as far as organized crime. And they're really beginning to find out that, you know, Sam Giancana is likely the head of the outfit. Now, Tony Accardo and Rico were very smart in the fact of knowing that, you know, Sam at this point was vulnerable. He was a little out there and he was very much willing to kind of be the fall guy, if you will. The feds start tapping Giancana. The problem for the feds was a lot of them were illegal taps, and Sam was smart and cunning and wasn't willing to really say much on them, but he would actually ultimately sue the FBI and would testify in front of the feds after he alleged that it was harassment and they were infringing on his rights by illegally wiretapping him, which he would actually win. But this would really start the process of Tony Accardo just not really liking the behavior that Sam Giancana is evolving in. He's becoming a little too public. He's making a mockery out of the federal government. And, you know, look, whether it was Sam DiStefano, whether it was Tony Spilotro, we've seen a lot of these guys in Chicago where you had a strict line in the sand. There were the guys that were the stone cold gangsters that didn't talk, like Joey Doves or Paul Rica or Tony Accardo or Nitty even. And then you had these brash lunatics like Giancana, DiStefano, Tony Spilotro. And look, you know, the reason that Chicago was so successful for so long is because they maintained anonymity. They weren't loud like the boys over in New York. The thing that Giancana realized, and this is something that the mob in Chicago realized and had realized really since the late 30s, that the movie business was huge. And you know, they were very involved and had always been very involved with Hollywood. What they were basically doing is extorting all the big studios over there, all the big unions, and they were forcing labor to really be intact. And this would allow them to also kind of move into Las Vegas, as we know through the Teamsters. At one point, it was said the Chicago outfit had the Riviera, the Stardust, the Trop, the Hacienda, the Fremont, and the Sahara over really the next 10 years. We know the mob was integral in controlling Las Vegas. And Tony Accardo was really on the forefront of that, he and these guys. And Giancana was big in that. As we know, there was a lot of connections with Mo Dalitz out there. And, you know, he had Johnny Roselli out there, did Sam Giancana. The mob was really, at this point, the most powerful group in the country was Chicago. It's that simple. Through his connections also did Sam Giancana with Sam Santotrafficante. He was involved directly with Meyer Lansky through Havana. And Havana, Cuba was the place to be. It was really the Vegas of the tropics. And I think people realized that, Cuba was going to be that tropical oasis filled with casinos and restaurants and bars. And, the mob was making millions down there through sweetheart casino relationships with Fulgencio Bautista. It was really a great time. And what these gangsters are doing, like Meyer, like Giancana, like Traficante, is they were sinking a lot of their fortunes into Cuba. It was basically a busted lottery machine. It was a one-armed bandit that was throwing out dollars all day, every day. The problem was, as we know, in the late 50s, a young revolutionary, an anti-American dictator called Fidel Castro starts taking things over and really introduces communism. And by 1959, Fulgencio Batista is ousted and Castro is in complete control. One of the first things he does is outlaws casinos. And this is a fucking problem. As we know, Lansky lost millions. These guys lost millions. Even interestingly enough, during the upheaval and revolt, Santo Traficante was actually detained by the Cuban government and imprisoned. And a lot of people don't know this, that one of the individuals that was integral in getting Traficante out of jail was an individual called Jack Rubinstein, also known as Jack Ruby. And I know we all know that name from his involvement in the Lee Harvey Oswald killing. Jack Rubinstein was from Chicago. Jack Ruby was very much known to the outfit. He was very well connected. He knew a lot of people. And he was actually based out of Miami at this point. He was moving through Dallas and Miami. He had clubs in Dallas and in Miami. And he was integral in actually getting Santo Traficante out of prison down there. And he would actually always be taking care of favors for not only Giancana, but for other members of the outfit. Also around this time, there's an election happening in 1960. And it was always very well known that throughout a lot of the last 20 years, Sam Giancana was very connected with Joe Kennedy. In fact, a lot of people were. Frank Costello was very connected to Joe Kennedy. A lot of people knew the elder Kennedy. Remember, he was involved with bootlegging at one point. And we've heard about this in history, but John Kennedy was running for president. He needed Illinois and some of the other parts of the Midwest, swing states that the mob was in control of, particularly the outfit. And a lot of people believe that Sam Giancana was directly one of the most important people in getting John Kennedy elected. He would allow the 60 or so electoral votes in those Midwestern states to really swing into the hands of John Kennedy. Particularly on the West Side, there were plenty of voting banks that were controlled by the outfit. And if you know anything about the 1960 election, it was very much swung in the hands of Kennedy through Illinois and through some of those other states. By being elected, it was alleged, and through the connections that Joe Kennedy had with the mob, it was thought that once Kennedy would be elected, that his brother Robert Kennedy would stop the fucking assault on the mob. And Giancana realized, we have to do this because we need to get this fucking RFK off our back. And if Kennedy's elected, he'll probably pull the plug. The problem that Giancana was starting to have, though, is his continued obsession with being ostentatious and just really changing his life. He started acting a lot different, bringing attention to the mafia and into the outfit. And he begins gallivanting around with a woman called Phyllis McGuire. Some of the older listeners may remember the McGuire sisters. I mean, obviously, knowing about mob stuff, I know who Phyllis McGuire was, but she was one of the singers in the McGuire sisters. They were a 50s trio. They sang music, and Sam had a very public relationship with Phyllis McGuire. And it was actually said that in his later life, a lot of the money that he had actually went to Phyllis McGuire. She died a couple of years ago, but he had a very public relationship with Phyllis McGuire, and he was neglecting his duties. He was traveling a lot. He really wasn't acting as a boss of a family should act. And again, Tony Accardo is being pissed off. Why wouldn't he be? this guy's supposed to be the guy running shit. And instead of him running shit, you've got, you know, Butch Blossy running shit because you're gallivanting around with a singer. Now, look, I'm not going to lie to you. Phyllis McGuire in her heyday was fucking beautiful. She just, you know, had that look to her. But, you know, Giancana was really just never the same after his wife died. You know, actually, to just remind everyone, Phyllis McGuire actually died in 2020, not long ago, actually, you know, less than 2 years ago. She was 89 years old. But throughout all this, Giancana is dating Phyllis McGuire. He's the head of the outfit, and he has a lot of connections inside the government. He basically got Kennedy elected. He had a president kind of on his purview. And we remember Frank Sinatra, he was very close with, and he had a relationship with Jack Kennedy. So everything was working out for the most part for Sam Giancana outside the crazy Cuba shit. But this would be something that would really make who Sam Giancana was, the legend of Sam Giancana. It was alleged, and this is actually in classified documents. You can read this directly from the upper echelons of the political class. It was alleged that the CIA would actually arrange a hit on Fidel Castro, and Robert Mayhew, who was an operative in the CIA, it was actually alleged that he put this together and went to Giancana through Johnny Roselli to arrange a hit on Fidel Castro. So basically what I'm saying is the government got into bed with the mob and said, we need Castro gone. We'll pay you to get rid of him. And it was alleged that Roselli, who was Giancana's point man in Vegas, would connect Giancana to Robert Mayhew, and he'd be offered $150,000 to take on the job to kill Castro. Also involved was Tampa boss Santo Trafficante. Now, it's funny because they actually came up with all these elaborate ways to kill Fidel Castro. They were going to just do a simple mob hit, shoot him in the head. They had thought about giving him pills, poisoning him, giving him a cigarette or a cigar that would blow up, hiring a girlfriend to befriend him and poison him. There was all sorts of things. The problem was the upper echelons of the FBI and the president or RFK or JFK didn't really know about this. At least that's what they say. They would actually find out and kill the operation. And it's funny on how they ended up finding out. Sam Giancana, by this point, his personal relationships were getting involved with his business, particularly with the CIA stuff. Sam Giancana actually went to Robert Mayhew and through some of the high echelon CIA people and was curious about Phyllis McGuire. He thought he was cheating on him. She thought he was cheating on him. And he asked the CIA to bug one of her apartments. One of the people that tried to bug it got caught by the FBI. And this is how it got to RFK and Hoover that this was all going on. So it really was fucked because of his obsession with Phyllis McGuire. And he thought that she was cheating on him. Now, ultimately, I don't believe she ever was, but that's how it all figured out. So that's how Fidel Castro is obviously was still in power up until very recently. He was never ultimately killed by the CIA. Sam's personal life was a complete mess. I mean, he was dipping his toes into private stock, if you know what I mean. He was messing with Phyllis McGuire. He had a long relationship with a woman called Judith Campbell Exner, who was also fucking John Kennedy. The Hollywood elite, particularly in the 60s, was very corrupt, particularly Kennedy, Sinatra, I mean, and the political class for that matter. Also, the problem that the mob also had was electing Kennedy didn't really change anything. Robert Kennedy was still a fucking annoyance. He never eased up on the mob. Accardo was sick of it. Everyone was tired of it. Sinatra was supposed to set everything up, and it was also supposed to go swimmingly, and Sinatra was betraying people. It was just all complete mess. And at the center of it was Sam Giancana. It's pretty simple. And then the stuff with Marilyn Monroe would happen. And look, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I don't know if Marilyn Monroe had some sort of magical, you know, punani, if you will, but it's amazing how many people she mystified by fucking them. It wasn't just one class of people either. Like Marilyn Monroe fucked athletes, singers, actors, presidential candidates, mobsters, regular doormen at hotels. Like she was a sexual deviant that was obsessed with having sex. Like she fucked everybody. And by this point, everyone's fucking Marilyn Monroe. Giancana is, Kennedy is, everybody's fucking Marilyn Monroe. You have to wonder what her list looked like. How many people smashed Marilyn Monroe? I mean, it's got to be in the thousands. She had a sexual obsession. It was pretty simple. And look, I've always believed that the mob killed Marilyn Monroe. I don't need to go into like what happened to her. If you've watched like E! Trial of Hollywood Story, you know what happened to Marilyn Monroe. She was supposedly overdosed. But a lot of people believe that Giancana orchestrated that. He was with Marilyn Monroe basically the nights before she died. And what the mob actually did was had her killed. They placed some letters with Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, around her and trying to get him brought in on the whole thing. Problem was the Secret Service showed up right after it, got rid of all the evidence, and Kennedy was never really tied to it. But yeah, look, it's a foregone conclusion. I don't think the Kennedys had the balls to kill her. The mob killed her, and they tried to pin it and make it look like Robert Kennedy was somehow involved. I don't think he was. I don't think he was just that kind of guy. But everyone was fucking Marilyn Monroe. It's just that simple. As we know, in November of 1963, John Kennedy is killed. Now, what I'm about to talk about is alleged. Do I think Sam Giancana was directly involved with the murder of John Kennedy? I do. I think there was a group of people involved, particularly Carlos Marcello, Santo Trafficante, and Giancana. Now, Giancana actually would tell a brother of his that he supplied the shooters that day, and that Lee Harvey Oswald was really just a fall guy. If you know anything about Harvey Oswald, he was connected to Carlos Marcello. He knew outfit people. He was very connected in the underworld. Do I think that he supplied the shooters? No. I mean, Giancana would tell his brother Pepe that he supplied an individual called Richard Kane and Milwaukee Phil Attoricio, and they were the killers that day. There was also another guy, Nicoletti, supposedly involved, and that there were three shooters as opposed to one. If you know anything about Richard Kane, it was actually proven that he was likely not even in Dallas that day. According to a guy called John Flood, who worked with Richard Kane, he would say that Kane was actually in Chicago that day. Also, an historian called Lamar Waldron, in his book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, he would say that Richard Kane did not shoot the president, but actually act as an informant on behalf of Johnny Roselli for the assassination attempt. So people would say that Giancana supplied shooters, and they would also say that at one point the guns that were supplied were from the outfit. We've heard all that stuff. Who do I think ultimately killed John Kennedy? Look, I can't for sure tell you who the killers were. I can tell you that the mob orchestrated it, in my belief. And if you know anything about Robert Blakely, who was on the Warren Commission, he actually would agree with that. I think Marcello was integral in it. I think Giancana was integral in it. And I think Trafficante were integral in it. Also, we know just by knowing who Jack Ruby is, Jack Ruby was very connected from Chicago. He was from the Patch. He knew everyone. He knew outfit people. He would obviously kill Lee Harvey Oswald to kind of silence him. If you know anything about Ruby, Ruby was like scheduled to die anyway. He had a very bad sickness and he was going to die anyway. It was just too perfect to me. So basically in what I'm saying here is I think Giancana was directly involved with Marilyn Monroe. He was brought in by the CIA to kill Castro. That was definitely planned because it's been documented in classified documents. And I do think he had a hand in the Kennedy assassination. If you know anything about Roselli and his people, he definitely was involved. And by this point in the mid 60s, the outfit is absolutely done with Giancana. They're sick and tired of his behavior. He had really gotten one too many chances, quite honestly. And the problems now were Tony Accardo was starting to get blamed for his behavior. Because remember, I mean, way back in the 40s, when Giancana went to Accardo about the numbers stuff, he kind of, in a way, vouched for Giancana. He took him from really an associate to, you know, a full-fledged member. And at one point said, I think this guy should be boss. And remember, by this point, Tony Accardo had been grooming others to kind of take over control. Paul Rica would at one point kind of confront Accardo about Giancana, and say, you know, you're the guy that brought this guy around. He's a fucking asshole. We got to get rid of this guy. And that's what happened. In 1965, he would basically be pulled and relieved of duty and told to get the fuck out of Chicago. It's exactly what he did. Sam Giancana would flee to Mexico, and he'd actually live in Mexico for about 10 years. Sam Giancana would live in an area called Cuernavaca, which is in Morelos, in the state of Morelos in Mexico, really not too far from Mexico City. He'd actually be arrested by the Mexican authorities in 1974 and deported back to the United States after some legal issues. And he'd come back and arrive back several days later on July 21st, 1974. You know, the police were trying to protect Giancana. The outfit for the last 9 or 10 years could deal with him not being around. But now that he was back, there was a lot of concern of what Sam Giancana would do. He was a bit of a loose cannon. He was someone that likely they just couldn't really deal with having around. Plus, there was things hanging over him, his involvement with the CIA. He was scheduled to appear in front of the church committee, which was a special committee that was investigating abuses by the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI. So Giancana was kind of a loose end. And, you know, there's different theories as to who killed him and why he was killed. A lot of people will bring up the fact that maybe Trafficante did it after he worried about some of the CIA stuff. But my thought is Tony Accardo approved it and was done with Giancana. And he had to go. On the evening of June 19th, 1975, Sam Giancana is in the basement of his home in Oak Park, Illinois, where he allegedly lets in an individual that he knows. The individual goes in his house. Sam's cooking sausage and peppers in his kitchen in the basement. At that point, he's shot 7 times in the head and neck with a .22 caliber pistol. At 11 p.m. that night, an individual named Joseph DePersico finds the body of Sam Giancana in his basement. His daughter would identify the body, and he was buried at Mount Carmel Cemetery in Illinois. Now, who killed Giancana is up for debate. I think the most logical situation was Butch Blassie killed him. If you know anything about that night, he let the individual in his home. And remember, the feds are watching his house, so it was pretty difficult to really even get in there. Butch Blassie knew him best. It was likely that Accardo went to him and said, look, you know him best. He trusts you. Go get rid of him. And by this point, I think everyone could kind of see the light. It was probably tough for Butch Blassie to do it, but he had to go. He was actually questioned as a suspect, but, you know, the family in the FBI never actually thought he killed Sam Giancana. During the 2000s, an individual called Nicholas Calabrese would tell the FBI that he knew that Tony Accardo was part of the killing and that certain members of the outfit not only got rid of the gun, but made the suppressors for the gun. So my belief is Butch Blassie killed Sam Giancana. Remember, Blassie was his best of friend. And by this point, Giancana had to be smart to realize that his antennas were up. He probably was not going to last very long. And he probably trusted Butch Blassie. And remember, in the end, in the mob, generally your friends are the ones that kill you. And that's exactly what happened here. Sam Giancana just became too public. He became a loose end. But we have to remember, he was involved in some very big parts of the last 100 years in this country. I mean, everything from JFK to Marilyn Monroe to the CIA and Fidel Castro and the election of John Kennedy to the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was pretty incredible how involved he was. He really lived a wild life. He went from being, you know, just a petty criminal killer on the streets to someone that the cops couldn't bring in to, you know, a numbers runner who took over the business, made a ton of money, you know, was on top of the world. But we look back at the insular moment that I think really changed the life of Sam Giancana, and that was the death of his wife. We have to wonder, where would Sam Giancana have been if not for the death of Angeline Dottolvi? Remember, a lot of the problems that Sam Giancana arised were from his relationship with Phyllis McGuire, his involvement with having sex with high-level women that were also very involved with others. It was really the golden era of the mob. I mean, this is what we did this show for, to go over people like Sam Giancana, who literally were at the top of the heap as far as mobsters were concerned. Now, do we look at Sam Giancana as a capable leader? Yeah, he definitely did some incredible things. He was involved with some incredible plots, but in the end, his own behavior did him in. And, you know, sometimes you're your own worst enemy, and that's exactly what Giancana was. This is why people like Tony Accardo are legends in mob history, because the only way to be as a mobster is low level, not acting crazy, not acting out there, not being an attention seeker. All the attention seekers either went to jail or got a two in the head. You know, we look at in Chicago, whether it was Spalatro or DeStefano or whoever, John Gotti, Carmine Galanti, Joey Gallo, all these guys that became too public, that never works. We look at the one guy in the history of American mafia crime in history that never went to prison. It was Tony Accardo. He's a perfect mobster. He was the better version of Giancana. Giancana was powerful. And for a 5, 6, 7 year period, he did a lot for the mob. Really from 1940 till 1965, Sam Giancana did a lot of big things and was involved with a lot of big situations. But in the end, he just was too big. He got too public. As always, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode on Sam Giancana. I know it was a lot of info. However, I wanted to try to present it in as easy possible and as easy to follow as possible. As always, make sure, as I said, you give us a deserved rating. You communicate with us on Twitter. You can find us at SitDown7. And go check us out on YouTube as well. You can find the show just by searching The Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. I want to thank all the listeners. I think we've put out some really great episodes recently. Obviously, we did the one this week. We did Vinny Basciano last week. Interviewed Frank Fiorellino a couple of weeks ago. Had some really good episodes recently, and I hope you guys are enjoying them. Next week, we'll get into another great mafia topic. I am Jeff Nadeau. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time here on The Sit Down.